Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This spring, communities across the country will be celebrating the 200th birthday of Frederick Law Olmsted, co-creator of New York City's Central Park and numerous subsequent parks. His sons, John Charles and Frederick Law Jr., followed in their father's footsteps, and it is in part because of John Charles Olmsted that Portland has a celebrated park system that we enjoy today. Today, we talk with urban naturalist and frequent Locus Focus guest Mike Houck, and Jim Shulin, who serves on the board of directors for the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust, about the importance today of Olmsted's legacy in Portland. Mike and Jim, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And it's great to have you on the phone. I just want to mention to the listeners, we're doing this show live. It's been a few weeks since I've been in the studio, but we're all wearing our blue masks and doing it live. So, Mike, I want to start by asking you, why have you been putting so much energy into helping coordinate this national celebration of 200th anniversary of Frederick Law Olmsted's birthday?
Well, I long ago read a book called Clearing in the Distance, which is a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted Sr., and was totally blown away by the contributions he made to this country and to the world, really. Not just with regard to parks, to creating Central Park and Prospect Park and similar parks around, literally around the U.S. But he was a social reformer. He fostered equitable access to parks for everybody. He's considered the founder of the American Society of Landscape Architects. He wrote for the New York Times, actually the predecessor to the New York Times, which sent him to the South to document the evils of slavery. And he wrote a book, Journeys and Explorations in the Cotton Kingdom, where he outlined the horrific impact that slavery had actually on everyone in the South, not just the slaves, but the folks who, the poor white folks who actually had lower wages due to slavery, and documented the economic and social evils of slavery. So I think it's important that we recognize him as well as his son, John Charles Olmsted, who was brought to Portland in 1903. There is interesting, given where we're at right now with the Charter Commission, it was a change in the city's charter that created a citizen park commission that actually sent one of their members, Thomas Lamb Elliott, to Boston to recruit John Charles Olmsted, because the firm was quite well known for its park work, and brought Olmsted to Portland in April of 1903 to create a park master plan for Portland.
Well, a friend of mine was asking the other day when I was mentioning that we're going to be doing this show, and I mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted. He said, he developed Central Park and Laurelhurst Park. But actually, Frederick Law Olmsted never set foot in Portland. So
Correct. What
is the connection between Frederick Law Olmsted Sr. and Portland, and why is it so important in your mind that we celebrate this legacy, even though Frederick Law Olmsted never set foot in Portland?
Well, we're really celebrating the legacy of the Olmsted firm for Frederick Law Sr., who, in addition to parks like Central Park and Prospect Park, actually came to the Mariposa mine in California. He was under contract for mining interests there, and was soon recruited to write a recommendation and a rationale for establishment of Yosemite National Park. So he had an influence across the United States, including the creation of the national park system. And then, of course, via his son, John Charles, who came to Portland. So it's really in celebration of the firm's work on parks throughout the United States. And, of course, John Charles Olmsted and Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. both carried on the tradition from their father regarding equitable access to parks. Viewing parks, by the way, he very explicitly described parks as infrastructure, as civic infrastructure, not a nice to have, a need to have. And interestingly, it took us until very recently, till we convinced about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, City Council to declare Portland Parks and Recreation Bureau a civic infrastructure bureau, so rising it to the level of roads and sewers and so forth.
Well, I know, Mike, that you've been involved in a long time in promoting what you call green infrastructure. In fact, there was a while where I think you were calling it green infrastructure.
Right.
How do parks fit into your whole vision of the importance of green infrastructure? Let's first of all say what green infrastructure is, and then how do parks play a role in that?
Well, there's natural, what I consider natural green infrastructure, areas like Forest Park, Oaks Bottom, and Smith and Bybee Lakes. And then there is built green infrastructure, bioswales, eco-roofs, and so on and so forth. And the whole logic behind actually protecting natural areas and creating built green infrastructure is that it costs less to manage stormwater. It costs less to do a number of things, and as opposed to simply relying on engineered solutions on pipes, underground pipes.
John Charles Olmsted wrote this master plan for the Portland Parks, is that correct, back in 1903?
Correct.
Jim, could you talk a bit about what's in that plan and how much it actually materialized?
Yeah, Barbara, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to the connection to Laurelhurst, if I could, because I can tie that into to the question you just asked. So the park plan that Olmsted provided for Portland, the Portland Park Board in 03, interestingly, didn't have a real map or a plan view, if you would like to call it that, of the city outlining the places where park should be and Park Boulevard should be. But shortly thereafter, a couple of renditions emerged. I think the Oregonian came up with one. And then the one that has C.P. Kaiser, Charles Paul Kaiser's name on it, was actually something that his staff made for him, I'm sure. And by that time, places like Laurelhurst Park, Peninsula Park, City Park up in the West Hills, as we called Washington Park in the old days, started to appear on the map. So things were taking place. I wanted to mention that there was one of the park directors before C.P. Kaiser was a man named Emanuel Tillman Misch. And he was a landscape architect, and he was trained, apparently, by the Olmsted firm. And he was the one who did those magnificent early park designs for Mount Tabor, Laurelhurst, and Peninsula Parks, and most likely City Park or Washington Park as well. So there is a design aspect that we did inherit through the, luckily, through the Olmsted firm. The parkways that appeared on the first edition of the rendering of the map that I'm familiar with, included parkways, say, from Mount Tabor Park down Hawthorne Boulevard west towards presumably a bridge. I don't know exactly when the Hawthorne Bridge was built, but there was to be a park down near about 11th and 12th and Hawthorne, if you can imagine. Where that is, that was to be called Hawthorne Park. That obviously didn't happen, nor did that boulevard connection. But some things did. And so pieces of these, what we call park blocks around the city that you see are really from that planning effort or, just sort of evolved out of that planning effort. And so things never really got tied together and connected in the way that Olmsted envisioned.
Well, one of the things that I noticed, I was looking over the plan this morning that you sent me this very early this morning, Mike, and there is a great emphasis on parkways, which I'm assuming are paved roads that people drive on that would have mainly trees on both sides of the road, and not much mention of trails. And I wonder, was there something in his plan that also included a system of trails, or is that something that came later?
Well, Jim referred to City Park, or what we now know as Washington Park, and in fact, he envisioned in reading the plan, and by the way, the information I sent was, I literally went through and read every line of the plan and excerpted things that seemed most interesting, that they should be separated. There would be parkways and boulevards for carriages, and then separate to that, if necessary, there would be the ability of people to walk adjacent to them. And I think one of the interesting things about Olmsted's plan, I don't know if Jim will agree with me on this or not, but he also went to Seattle and to Spokane. And the difference between the Seattle plan and the Portland plan was Portland was too cheap they wouldn't even pay for him to hire an assistant or to, as Jim pointed out, to create a map. So Portland did it on the cheap. Seattle actually contracted with him to do park design in Seattle. So they're very much about design of parks. We, I think, interestingly, benefited by the fact that there wasn't a map, there wasn't anything too tied to a specific design. And we have been free, in my case, to really focus on the natural resources, the green infrastructure aspects, and in Jim's case, in the 40-mile loop, to take that original concept of a carriageway, parkways and boulevards for carriages, and change it to accommodate our current needs, which is more focused on pedestrians and bicycles through the 40-mile loop. I don't know if Jim would agree with that or not, but I think we actually are fortunate in not being too tied to a specific design concept.
Well, I kind of remember that when John Charles Olmsted looked at what became Forest Park, he basically said to the city leaders, don't do anything to this, just leave it. It's a masterpiece as it is. Is that true?
I don't recall that explicitly, but the entire West Hills really was, to him, a potential park for the most part. He really argued that steep slopes should not be built upon and that a very significant park and parkway would be throughout the West Hills, going all the way from south from what is now the Riverview Cemetery, which was a cemetery at the time. And fortunately, we do have the land adjacent to that Riverview Natural Area all the way into Forest Park. A quick aside, the last thing I read this morning about forest reservations, he also actually advocated to create a working forest that would help fund the park system, which I actually had not remembered. But he traveled the world, Frederick Law Sr. traveled the world, and John Charles, of course, was aware of the parks in Germany where they actually utilize commercial forests to fund their systems.
What do you think of that idea? I mean, just imagining having logging in Forest Park.
No. Well, and the interesting thing, of course, he was a man of his times, and they had different philosophies. For example, again, in City Park or Washington Park, he actually advocated, although he really had a predilection toward native species. He said that English ivy was a pretty good ground cover. Well, obviously today, I don't think Jim would agree with that, having worked for Portland Park and Recreation for many years.
Was he a fan of Morning Glory as well, maybe?
No, I don't recall that one.
Well, you listen to Locus Focus on Cambridge Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFT LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with urban naturalist Mike Hauck and Jim Shulin, who's with the 40-Mile Loop Land Trust, about the importance today of the Olmsted's legacy in Portland. Mike, I wanted to just kind of get a picture, if you can rebuild it, of what Portland looked like back in 1903. I mean, when he talked about having a boulevard that would have gone from Mount Tabor, or a parkway that would have gone from Mount Tabor to the Hawthorne Bridge when that got built. It seems like there was a lot of natural landscape still in Portland at that time, which could have become anything.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, they didn't call it Stump Town for nothing. So there were a lot of trees that were cut as the city started to develop. But the West Hills, as we know, also had incredibly what he described as incredibly beautiful ravines and so forth. McClay Park was part of the park system at that time. He advocated for a large watery park in the Columbia Sloughs. Forest Park, of course. I mean, that would be part of the system in the West Hills.
Now, Forest Park wasn't actually a park in those days.
No, it was not. But I believe Portland, and Jim again can corroborate this or not, there was a donation of a portion of Balch Creek, McClay Park, but it was pretty small compared to, you know, what Forest Park is today. He recognized the importance of Ross Island. His vision for Ross Island certainly is not consistent with what I'd like to see today, but he thought Ross Island would make a wonderful place for folks to take a ferry to. And in fact, I think it was Mish, Jim, that came up with a plan that had it as a very formal garden with tennis courts and so on and so forth. This is, again, back in the early 1900s.
Actually, it makes me think about two islands in Canadian cities, Granville Island in Vancouver and Princess Island in Calgary, which I think, in my mind, when I visited both of those islands, they've been devastated by development. So maybe we're lucky. I mean, it's hard to imagine Ross Island. Ross Island's been devastated in other ways.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of Ross Island and how that has been transformed recently by growing awareness of the importance of natural landscapes in wetland areas.
Well, first of all, he did recommend Ross Island come to the park system. Again, the view then was quite different than it is today, given our interest in natural resources as well. Well, as we all know, all Portlanders know, I think, Ross Island sand and gravel had been dredging Ross Island for aggregate until around 2000, when steelhead and salmon were listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. Then their ability to excavate the window for that activity closed quite a bit. And so they moved their operation in terms of getting raw materials up the Columbia River, continued to process on Hayden Island. There are actually four islands. A lot of people just think of Ross Island. There's Ross Island, Hayden Island, Toe Island, and East Island. And as we all now know from reading the Tribune and other sources, there's a huge financial issue going on with Ross Island. They transferred the island to the retirement fund, actually. So,
which retirement fund?
Well, their employees. Retirement fund may not be the appropriate term, but it's their retirement. So they now own Ross Island, which is very strange, and there's going to be a lot of digging into that. And of course, that raises the question: in the state of Oregon, Department of State Lands is requiring them to continue the restoration and complete it by now. It's been pushed out and pushed out to 2035, I believe, before their obligations are achieved, we hope. We know the city of Portland, of course, a bunch of us got together and worked very hard to get Ross Island to donate 50 acres to the city of Portland. So the city of Portland owns a major portion of Ross Island, and including land that the Port of Portland gave the city a few years back. So Ross Island is very much up in the air. We're hopeful, of course, that we bring the entire, all four islands into city ownership.
I know that there was this, like the dredging that was going on down by the Opera and OMSI. There was this, I guess it was when they were pulling all the fill out of the big pipe excavation. Weren't they dumping that into the Ross Island Lagoon?
Absolutely. The city actually saved quite a lot of money by doing that. They didn't have to cart it off, you know, to some much greater distance.
So, I mean, how good was that for the area? Because it seems like it's been a majorly abused landscape from all the dredging that Ross Island Sand and Gravel did.
Well, Ross Island benefited dramatically because the whole point of the restoration plan was to create a lot of shallow water habitat for fish, emergent wetlands, and riparian habitat. So the plan has been tweaked more recently, but the idea is not to fill the entire lagoon up. They went down to minus 130 feet at least. The old plan from 1979, they were required to fill the entire lagoon. Now they're focusing on shallow water habitat, on creating a buffer to the buttressing to the now very narrow strip of land between Ross Island and Hardtack Island.
Actually, so all those islands used to be separate. I remember going down there with some longtime Selwood neighbors who referred to the Ross Island archipelago.
Right.
But, I mean, it wasn't an archipelago anymore because there are these land bridges, is that correct, that the Army Corps of Engineers built between the islands?
They built a berm between Ross Island and Hardtack Island. What that did was it changed the hydrology of the river, forcing the most of the flow of the river to the west side of Ross Island. That resulted in scouring of Little Toe Island, what now is Little, very small Toe Island. And contrary to that, on the Holgate Channel side, their accretion started. So there was no East Island back in 1926 when the Corps of Engineers put in that berm. So that it has the hydrology of the rivers changed pretty dramatically. And, of course, Ross Island and Hardtack Island were not joined until that berm went in.
So how does this all fit into the larger plan? I'm thinking about how to integrate or how it has been integrated with the more formal park plans and the wilder park plans.
Well, you know, that's actually the hallmark of Olmsted's 1903 plan. He argued for a comprehensive, interconnected park system. Parks, he didn't use natural areas, he didn't use nature explicitly, but he included areas like what would become Forest Park, Ross Island, along with the need for, as Jim pointed out, squares, neighborhood parks, and playgrounds. That was the hallmark of his work, and I think why Portland benefited so much from it, was the notion that rather than a hodgepodge of parks here, hither and yon, that there actually needed to be a very well-planned out distribution of parks, both with respect to what he called scenic reservations, those areas where you go for quiet contemplation of nature, versus playgrounds such as Columbia Park and Peninsula, or Holiday Park, I think was what he referred to at that point. Holiday and Columbia both existed. Those were for active recreation, for baseball and so on and so forth. So that was the incredible aspect of his plan that Portland did follow for the most part, and we're fortunate to have that comprehensive park system.
Now, I was told, I'm not sure this is true, that John Charles Olmsted was also responsible for helping design Selwood Park. Is that correct?
He recommended that Selwood Park be created. I think Jim, correct me if I'm wrong on this one. Was there a race course? A horse?
Yes, there was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he saw a park there as being very important for the Selwood
because
community.
Because what's interesting to me is that park seems to incorporate all the elements that John Charles Olmsted was talking about. I mean, there's a lot of recreation. I mean, there's a baseball field, there's a football field, there's a soccer field, there's tennis courts, there's a pool, and that's in the upper park. And then you have the lower park, which has a bowl for concerts, and then it has a wild river beach, and also the kind of small natural area in the lower riverfront park. And I wonder, whose vision was that, and was that inspired at all by Olmsted?
Well, certainly it was. I was going to comment that, of course, adjacent to Selwood Park, what do we have? 160-acre Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge. And actually, that brings up the point that, from my perspective, Portland Parks and Recreation lost sight of the original Olmsted plan with regard to its comprehensiveness, and natural areas were not really much paid attention to for many, many years through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, where the focus was on the recreational parks. And Oaks Bottom, of course, at that time in the 60s and 70s, the city was contemplating filling and creating a motocross course, thanks to people like Frank Ivancy. Yacht Harbor and all kinds of weird uses down there. And it was only in the 80s when, actually I will say that one of the most important alliances with regard to park advocates, from my perspective, was when Barbara Walker and other folks founded the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust. Barbara showed me a map of what the 40 Mile Loop would look like, and it blew me away because all these great natural areas and parks really fell along the loop. So that created, I think, a very important coalition, which started working on bringing back Olmsted concept of the scenic reservations of the natural areas, as well as the other park types that the loop falls on.
What do you think is missing from Portland Park's current plan that was in the original Olmsted proposal?
I think probably the biggest gap between what was proposed and what exists today are the parkways and boulevards. I mean, the only real parkway you can point to today that is actually in place is Twilliger. We do have a very nice what I would call a boulevard on Willamette Boulevard is part of what he recommended in 1903, that it would extend from Selwood all the way into St. John's. So as you read through the park plan, of his park plan, there are, I don't know, 10 or 15 boulevards and parkways he advocates. And the only one that I would consider in place today would be Twilliger.
Well, I'm trying to imagine Hawthorne Boulevard as a parkway as opposed to what it is now. If that had happened, and also well, that would have kind of followed the course of Brooklyn Creek, wouldn't it?
Oh, you got me there.
Well, I thought you were an expert on Brooklyn Creek, Mike, having followed its course.
Well, we did. Yes, we did. Well, interestingly, I'm going to read something now.
Okay.
This is an excerpt from the plan that struck me during the first reading. Marked economy and municipal development may also be affected by laying out parkways and parks so as to embrace streams that carry at times more water than can be taken up by drain pipes of ordinary size. Thus, brooks or little rivers, which would otherwise become nuisances that would someday have to be put in large underground conduits at enormous expense, may be made the occasion for delightful local pleasure grounds and attractive parkways. So there, right there, is a statement about green infrastructure in 1903 that, and of course, we didn't learn that lesson for the most part. Most of the streams in the city, of course, were put underground. And the creek you referred to, we did follow one day. In fact, we went down a manhole cover in front of Produce Row, where you can actually see the Willamette River, and the stream flows through that huge underground culvert. And so 1903 says, no, we should actually maintain those streams as parkways. And he didn't use the word nature or wildlife habitat, but that certainly was implied in his recommendations.
So, Jim, I just wanted to get a sense of what it would have been like if Hawthorne Boulevard had been Hawthorne Parkway instead.
Wow. Well, can't you imagine a tree-lined boulevard, kind of like the park blocks in downtown Portland, and maybe some green landscape in the median areas that ran straight up to Mount Tabor Park. That would have been fantastic.
So there'd be no stores, no commerce at all. It just basically have been a park, a road through a park, and then the neighborhood businesses and homes and everything would be off on the other side of that little strip of woods?
Yeah, well, there would be storefronts. I would think if I were a shopkeeper, I would really love to have a spot on a boulevard like that. It's just that there would have been more space given to landscape and probably a slower paced boulevard than we have now. So now we're trying to get people to slow down. And I think a green boulevard, as I'm envisioning, people wouldn't travel so fast on. So I think it would have been gorgeous.
So now we're building swales along Hawthorne to sort of recreate some semblance in nature.
Well, yes, but kind of a poor substitute for a really leafy green boulevard, in my opinion.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with urban naturalist Mike Houck and Jim Chulin, who's with the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust, about the importance today of the Olmsted legacy in Portland. And right now we're sort of imagining what it would have been like if John Charles Olmsted's vision of these boulevards that were actually parkways connected the natural area. So let's talk about some of the others. It's weird because there's these little moments in Portland where you get a sense of a parkway. But and actually one of them is like 72nd Street on the east side, which has a median.
Right.
Another one is Ainsworth in northeast Portland, in North Portland. But none of them are like exactly like business districts. So I'm trying to imagine what it would have been like if we had these business districts with these parkways.
Maybe the closest we have to that is the park blocks again in downtown.
No, that's
we
a good example.
We have commercial and yeah.
And actually, it seems to me that when the Pearl District started getting extended up to the north, now there's a whole series of parks in the north end of what's kind of downtown Portland. And I'm wondering how much those parks were inspired by the plan that John Charles Olmsted came up with.
Well, you know, there was talk in the, I think probably the 1990s, about the thought of extending the north, the park blocks all the way through the U.S. Postal Service building and back to the Willamette River. Comparisons made to Barcelona, people were talking about. And unfortunately, not all of that happened, although I think some of the parks that we have in the Pearl now might have been more or less along that alignment.
I remember when that discussion was going on, it was going to mean taking out a whole lot of buildings, actually, because the park blocks end on Salmon Street, the South Park blocks, and then you've got a bit of North Park blocks that are just north of Burnside. And there's actually some very interesting historic buildings and kind of cool little funny streets like Ankeny that I think a lot of people were attached to not taking out. So it's the whole thing, again, like daylighting streams, which we've been talking about on this show for, I don't know, I've been talking with Mike about it for at least, 30 years or something. The challenge is, well, there's the feasibility of being able to do it, the quality, the health quality or lack of health quality, some of these streams that have been culverted, and then there's this kind of public resistance to changing the way things are. So I wonder how that all factors in trying to maybe resurrect some of Olmsted's dreams for Portland and try to find a way to do more connectivity.
Well, I don't know if this is a stretch or not, but you referenced the Pearl District. There's a park triptych there. It's Jameson Square, Tanner Springs, and the Fields. And that's very much in line with Olmsted's concepts from 1903 in that he argued that parks should have their own character. Parks should provide something different, that it's not a monotonous series of parks. And in that case, of course, Jameson Square was created to create this beautiful water feature that kids from throughout the region, not just locally, but there are people come from across the region to take their kids to Jameson Square. Tanner Springs, there was a very concerted effort and a lot of research that went into, is it possible to daylight Tanner Creek? Well, it turned out it was way too far buried. And so
would have been Tanner Gorge, right? If they'd actually.
Yeah, right. So Greenworks, a local landscape architecture firm, and Herbert Dreisaitl out of Germany got together, had numerous community workshops to try to figure out what folks in the Pearl and outside the Pearl as well would like to see there. And since daylighting wasn't possible, they, of course, created a faux wetland with native vegetation. And I will say that 1 week after dedication of that park, I was driving north on Northwest 10th, and this flash went across my windshield. And I looked, and there was a woman standing with her mouth agape. And I stopped the car, leaped out, looked over the railroad ties that are down there, actually the metal rails, a beautiful artistic element to Tanner Springs. And there's an osprey with with a koi that immediately flew up and landed on one of the condos, proceeded to mute all over the window while I was eating this koi. Amazing. The other night I was walking by, there's a great blue heron down there. And then, of course, there's the Fields, which is a large grassy area for throwing frisbees and so on and so forth. So I think that was very much in keeping, and it's a linear series of parks that there's integrity to, that there's some sense to it. And as Jim pointed out, the plan was, the desire was to continue that to the Willamette. That's not come to fruition yet.
Well, I want to do a little thought experiment, and let's continue that series of parks there in Northwest Portland all the way down to Terminal 2, because when you're talking about the Osprey, it reminds me of being at Terminal 2 a few months ago with Bob Salinger, and while we're there, we first heard the peregrine falcon and then saw it actually on those huge things that they have in dock areas, and we weren't sure if it had actually made a nest there. But in the last time that Bob had been there, he saw an eagle. I mean, it's like there's a lot of wildlife. It's in the river, in the industrial area, in this industrial wasteland that we've created on the north reach of the Willamette. And I'm wondering if there's any thought about how to extend that park vision into the industrial area, as a lot of people are now rethinking the whole so-called industrial sanctuary that a lot of people think is an industrial sacrifice zone that comprises the Portland Harbor.
Well, there are going to be opportunities, I hope, through the Superfund, and Bob Salinger and others, Travis Williams with Willamette Riverkeeper, are all over that one. I have to admit, I've stayed away from that one, so it is challenging to imagine, but there are examples around the world where there has been a lot of restoration in formerly industrialized sites. And mentioning the Peregrine Falcon, by the way, interestingly, the most productive peregrine falcon nest in the state of Oregon is on the Fremont Bridge, which Bob and volunteers have been keeping an eye on for many years. And in fact, something like 4% of all the peregrine falcon nests, including Selwood, are on the bridges in Portland.
So Selwood Bridge has a peregrine falcon nest now.
Well, there are peregrines around there, yeah.
Yeah, I actually see them in Oaks Bottom and around. I didn't know if there was actually a nest on the bridge.
Right.
Another thing that's kind of a conundrum is that we've been hearing about the 40-mile loop for a really long time. I mean, I used to look for it when I first moved to Portland 50 years ago, because there'd be the sign saying 40-mile loop, but I didn't see any trail or anything. So, Jim, I'm wondering, first of all, discrepancy between the term 40-mile loop and the reality that I keep hearing that there's actually 160 miles of trail possibility. So let's talk about what the 40-mile loop really is, and will it really become a 160-mile loop?
Yeah, well, first about the name. So fortunately, there was an intern at Portland Parks, Ryan DeRocher, who interviewed Barbara Walker in 2002, and was recently uncovered, given to me by another former park worker. And she explains in the interview how the loop became known as the 40-mile loop. And Barbara Walker, to explain who she is, she was a real wonderful citizen activist involved with the 40-mile loop for decades. And she said that in the late 70s or early 80s, a park staff member took a little measuring wheel and ran it around the a rendition of the Olmsted plan, the one that we usually look at, and found, and they used this little handheld tool called an opposimeter, and it was before computers, etc. It found that loop, if you connected all of what C.P. Kaiser was dreaming about connecting together, was about 40 miles long. And even though they knew that their loop was going to be, because the loop hadn't really been master planned at that time, but they knew it was going to be way more than this planned rendition, probably over 100 miles. But the name stuck. The name 40-mile loop just stuck. And so it has no relation to what we're actually going for, which is a system of about 150 miles.
So where would this loop go?
The loop actually is comprised of a lot of trails that a lot of people are familiar with. They may not be familiar with every one of them. But the Wildwood Trail, for starters, which goes from Hoyt Arboretum up into Forest Park. It also includes the Marine Drive Trail along the river, the Columbia River. It includes a trail along the Columbia Slough that we call the Columbia Slough Trail. It includes the Springwater Corridor. It includes a little bit of Terwilliger Boulevard. It also includes the Gresham Fairview Trail and the Peninsula Crossing Trail. And then finally, last but not least, the North Portland Greenway, which is envisions connecting the Steel Bridge all the way up to Kelly Point Park by trail. So these are the components that we're working on. All together, those are known as the 40-mile loop.
So how far along are you in actually establishing this as a viable 150-mile loop?
Just over 70%. Isn't that pretty good?
That's quite good. And how many years have you been working on this?
Well, not me, but
Yes, you, Jim. Yes, you.
No. The organization has been in existence for just over 40 years, and the master plan was completed in May of 1983. We're going to celebrate 40 years of working on the 40-mile loop next year in reference to the master plan's publishing date. So, yes, a long time. Been working on it a long time.
What role is Portland Parks and Recreation playing in all of this?
Well, not only Portland Parks, but other agencies too. So we're a nonprofit organization. We don't manage any of the trails. We advocate for getting the trails done and getting them done as soon as possible. So we work with Portland Parks. In Portland, we work with the city of Troutdale and Troutdale. We work with the city of Gresham and others, city of Fairview as well. So the 40-mile loop, when it was planned, there was no regional trail system back in 1983. That hadn't been envisioned. So it really was kind of the first edition of a big trail system that connects parks and green spaces, natural areas, and, in a multi-jurisdictional sense. So we work with all of those cities that have, where we have 40-mile loop, and encourage them to submit grants. And I think right now we might have, there's been a recent round of grants. I think we have five or six different grants in for pieces of the 40-mile loop. So the local governments are key sponsors or key partners. And Metro has come on in a big, big way. Metro wasn't even in the parks business until around 1990. And they produced a Green Spaces Master Plan. They've been very active in helping us find money. They actually are a conduit for money. So the Metro bond measure that was passed in 2000, when was it, Mike, 2019?
Oh, the most recent one, yeah.
Yeah.
There have been three.
Yes, it's been very helpful for completing segments of the 40-mile loop and other trails, lots of other trails in the region. You should see the regional trail map. It goes all over the place. I don't know how many miles are included in it.
I know that one of the Metro bonds bought some land out towards where Mike was born, out along the Clackamas Drive, Highway 224.
On Barton Park.
Right. Well, before Barton Park, closer to Portland. But those, yeah. the hills, the bluffs that are just
as
you're heading southeast, they're on the left side. And I just wondered if, I mean, I know I haven't heard much about that park getting to be developed, but it was supposed to be the forest park of the east side. And I'm wondering if the 40-mile or the 150-mile loop would encompass trails that are that far out from the city.
Well, there is a plan, and Jim can probably corroborate this or not. There are plans to extend the Springwater Corridor up to Estacada. So there are definitely,
right.
And there are other efforts. For example, is it Strawberry Canyon out to the coast? Another trail out to the coast.
Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah. So anyway, the point being, yes,
yeah.
There's a regional vision
right.
out there. And I will say that actually, Barbara, myself, and other folks went to Metro in 1988 after they were asked to create or to do an inventory. Mel Huey conducted it. Of all the parks and trails in the metropolitan region. And what came out of that conversation was Metro agreeing they had a role for natural areas and for regional, at least park planning for the region back in 89-90. And as Jim pointed out, once the council voted to get into the natural areas biz and park biz, they passed the first bond in 95, the second one in 2006, and then the more recent one. It's almost, I think it's $500 million at this point. Metro now has 17,000 acres of natural areas. They had none in 1988. And as Jim pointed out, they've really done a great job, again, Mel Huey and now Robert Spurlock at Metro, to bring folks together to think about the regional trail system.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with urban naturalist Mike Houck and with Jim Sulin, who's with the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust. And we're talking about the importance today of the Olmsted legacy in Portland and what we've done with Portland parks since then. I see your hand is raised, Mike, but actually I want to throw a question out to you because this has been something I've been thinking about for days. Besides John Charles Olmsted coming out to consult, there was another East Coaster who was brought out, I think a little bit later than John Charles, to consult with the city of Portland about development. And that was Robert Moses from New York City. And I just wonder, you know, I see these two very competing visions, and I just wanted to imagine for a second, if Robert Moses had won out more than John Charles Olmsted, what Portland would look like today.
Good question. In fact, it was interesting. There was a little confusion we were talking about. We're going to... I've been working with Commissioner Carmen Rubio's office to have a proclamation on April 20th before City Council recognizing the contributions of the Olmsted firm, John Charles in particular, but obviously it's Frederick Law Sr.'s birthday, April 26th. And there was a little confusion between Olmsted and Moses. And Moses... is certainly, from my perspective, from reading a lot of his work, is antithetical to everything the Olmsted stood for. So, yeah. I mean, he was in Portland. He definitely made recommendations in Portland.
Well, my latest image of Robert Moses was seeing the new version of West Side Story, and it opens up with this big scene, this area that's now Lincoln Center that was being demolished.
Urban renewal.
It was like urban slum removal, right, is what they called it. And I remember, I mean, I was spending a lot of time in New York back in Robert Moses' days, and I remember his whole approach to dealing with people of color, low-income people, people without power was just bulldoze their neighborhoods and push them out. Right. So I wonder, I mean, I see a little bit of Robert Moses thinking in South Portland, just north of Arthur, where that development went in the 60s, I guess. Mm-hmm. There was all that urban removal in South Portland, which stopped at Arthur. I understand there were all the old ladies, Lair Hill, stopped the bulldozers or some story like that. But I mean, I think Portland could have become a lot more like a lot of areas of New York that were just destroyed by Robert Moses. So I wonder what you think were the breaks that kept that from really happening.
Well, we did have pretty progressive leadership back in the day with Neil Goldschmidt and a lot of other, you know, more progressive planners. And I think that's one of the challenges is integrating a great parks and natural area system with land use planning. I will say that it's been a struggle because there were many years, starting back in 1980 when I started working as an urban naturalist with Audubon Society, I was told by planners in virtually throughout the region, there's no place for nature in the city. So that's been a big struggle, and we finally, I think, gotten over the hump, and the recognition that the urban growth boundary is not this sacrosanct thing that could never, ever move, and that having green spaces inside the UGB contributes to quality of life, to biodiversity, to response to climate change, and so on and so forth. That is a concept that has been slow in coming over the last 30, 40 years, but I think we're finally there, so it's... You know, it's progressive planning, which includes the statewide planning program and the regional planning, along with the need to recognize the importance of the green stuff inside the UGB as well as outside. It's not about an urban growth boundary, and you want to experience nature, you get in your car and drive to Mount Hood or drive to the coast. No, that's a very bankrupt concept.
Well, it also seemed to me it was really important that Neil Goldschmidt was instrumental in stopping the Mount Hood Freeway from going through Southeast Portland. I mean, that really flies in the face of Robert Moses.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, Mike, you most of the time that we've talked over the last many decades, we've been talking about natural areas in the city and natural resources, not in terms of them being exploited for commercial use, but for being, you know, part of preserving nature. But it seems like in your working on celebrating the Olmsted's birthday that you're also really concentrating on parks. And I wonder why this focus on parks and how does that sort of interweave with your focus for most of your life on natural areas?
Well, I've always been a proponent of as Olmsted argued in 1903, a comprehensive system. So we need the playgrounds, we need the active recreation, we need the public squares, we need the parkways, we need the trails, and we need the natural areas. They all come together as a comprehensive system. So my battle over many years was to get away from thinking we only needed active recreation parks and not natural areas. That was the battle for many years, and we're over that now.
Besides Oaks Bottom and Forest Park and Smith and Bobby Lakes, are there other natural areas in Portland that you see, and ones that have come into the park system more recently, that really show a change in thinking?
Yeah, I was involved with some of the acquisition, and one of the things I'm most proud of, actually, is adding acres to the park. So, first of all, Powell Butte had been owned by the Water Bureau since the early 20s, and it was just sitting there as a future site for reservoirs. And, in fact, there was a reservoir built prior to it opening as a park. But it hadn't been thought of by the Water Bureau, let's say, as a natural resource asset or park. And I don't know how this happened, but the city received a grant to implement a nature park on Powell Butte. And that was a big turning point, too. It was one of the most significant chunks that came into the city at that time. We also, as a public natural resource, we also expanded the Markham and Twilliger areas. And in fact, Markham Nature Park went from 45 acres to about 90. And then we added buffer areas along Twilliger. So we actually connected the two, got a very large conservation easement from the Oregon Health Science University. Some 40 acres of conservation easement. So at any rate, lots of things happened at that time. And we also did some smaller scale things like Rosemont Bluff, a little scrap, a little remnant in northeast Portland. We looked at that and decided, well, yeah, it had value as a local natural area. And we attempted to do some restoration work there. And I think people are probably still trying to make the most of little areas as well as the large ones. We didn't have much property along the Columbia Slough. We acquired, along with BES, what we call Big Four Corners, just short of 185th. I think that's about 160 acres altogether. There have been numerous acquisitions of floodplain areas along Johnson Creek, and we were involved again with our partner BES and Metro in those acquisitions. I don't know what the acreage count is, but it's probably around, I'm going to guess, 250 acres, at least within the city of Portland. So a lot of good work has been done, and Gresham actually continued that work out along Johnson Creek in the city of Gresham.
Well, Jim and Mike, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Locus Focus. And Mike, just quickly, if people want to get involved in any of the Olmsted celebrations, what's coming up?
Yeah, I was going to say that Jim and I are just, you know, two folks on an ad hoc group that's been planning. The Portland Parks Foundation is through their series, but they're available online. Tomorrow night, Larry Cotton is going to present Frederick Law Olmsted, Bringing Nature into the City, at the Oregon Historical Society at 7 o'clock. Jim and I will be on again with Bill Hawkins on April 26th in Peninsula Park. And we're going to have a great celebration, Olmsted Ale at Lucky Lab on Southeast Hawthorne. They produced Olmsted Ale for us in 2003 to celebrate John Charles Olmsted's centennial of the Park Master Plan. And this will be celebrating both he and his father's birthday.
And you can bring your dog.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Mike and Jim, thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
We've been talking with urban naturalist Mike Houck and Jim Shulin with the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with environmental writer Marianne Lavelle, whose recent article in Inside Climate News explores the fossil fuel connections and climate implications of Russia's war on Ukraine. We'll go out with some music by Steve Lacy. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots or boosters, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Malala 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 mal